Hello, I'm Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Wesley J. Smith, the author of the vitally important book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published in hardcover by Times Books, copyright 1997. Wesley Smith is also the co-author with Ralph Nader of four different titles. Wesley, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your book is, once again, not only important but very timely. As we speak on the afternoon, or as we're recording this, on the afternoon of March 14th of 1999, the California State Legislature has introduced a right to die bill based on Prop 16 in Oregon. And in Forced Exit, you write a lot about Prop 16 and some of its major shortcomings. The language itself in Proposition 16 is extremely deceptive.
Well, and it's done on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I hope people will understand, regardless of what side they are on the assisted suicide issue, is that when proponents argue and write laws on behalf of assisted suicide, they try to give the great impression that this will be a very limited act, only rarely used, and then only as a last resort in terrible medical urgency for when pain cannot in any other way be alleviated. That's what they want people to think. But that's not how it is in real life. That's not how it's being practiced in Oregon. That's not how Kevorkian practices it. That's not how it's done in the Netherlands. It's all for show, and it's not real. And, you know, this country is getting to the place where we can't even discuss issues with candor. And if we can't discuss this issue, which is literally about life and death with candor, and if people are willing to say, oh, okay, I'll buy that myth, so they don't have to look deeper into the very disturbing and emotional issue, and it's a very hard issue to grapple with, no question about it, then I think we're giving up something very important in our freedom. That is, if we're going to make important public policies, we better damn well know what the hell we're talking about. And the thing, as you can tell by my voice, that frustrates me in this issue is people don't want to know what's really being talked about. They would rather believe fairy tales and make-believe.
I think that a bit of editorialization, this issue is the single most important issue before all of us, and that's saying quite a lot in light of the other vitally important issues. Everyone is going to travel down the path that you discussed in Forced Exit, whether they like it or not. And speaking of the people who've traveled down the path, there was a very deceptive report that came out on the, quote, success, unquote, of Proposition 16, and yet you pointed out in a column that was carried in the Wall Street Journal on February 25th of 1999 that already, even in the willfully deceptive language of the report on Prop 16, we're seeing a measured progress down the slippery slope.
Well, it's not even measured anymore. It's moving along at a much faster clip because of something that happened just last week. First, I'll go to the New England Journal of Medicine report. The media spin on the New England Journal of Medicine report made me think that all the press did was retype press releases issued by Right to Die groups. The spin, and your listeners probably heard this, only 15 people have killed themselves. None of them were in terrible pain. All of them were worried about issues of having to have assistance with daily living, worries about dependency. Nobody was worried about money. Isn't this wonderful? It's all working well. No abuses, no problems with safeguards, and so forth. Well, I read that, and I read the reports on it, and I thought, do these people have no memories? When Measure 16, the right to die law in Oregon, was being sold to the public, the purpose for it being agreed to was the last resort scenario I described earlier. Only when somebody in a long-term relationship with their doctor has nothing else that can be done to alleviate terrible and unremitting suffering.
Let me interrupt, if I could, Wesley, because those two points. One, terrible and unremitting suffering and long-term relationship with
the
doctors. Go ahead.
That's right. And that's how this was described to people. Then some of the very press people who put out this, well, this is a last resort, say, well, look, nobody was in pain who took the assisted suicide. Isn't that wonderful? The only reason they did it was they were afraid of having to have assistance with living. Well, wait a second. If the very thing that you put the law into place isn't the reason why people are using it, but they're using it for something else which is less dramatic and less worrisome. Yes, worries about having assistance are important. Yes, they can and are addressed every day by hospice, by physicians, by family members, assuring people that they're loved and valued even if they need help eating or bathing and so forth. But if we're going to say, oh gosh, you need help with living, that's grounds for a lethal prescription, then how in the world can you reduce it and limit it to people who are terminally ill? elderly people face this worry. Disabled people face this worry. So then some of your listeners might be saying, yeah, that's right. We should make it available to those people because that is a horrible thing. Well, you've just proved my point. The minute you think killing is an acceptable answer to one problem, suddenly there are 100 problems for which killing is acceptable.
And a point that you make in Forced Exit and that we've covered in past interviews is that euthanasia, while represented as a matter of choice and compassion, is actually a potentially deadly vehicle and a vehicle for social oppression against the disabled, the elderly, and the poor.
Absolutely, particularly people who don't have access to good medical care, and we can get to that in just a second.
We covered that before, but you point out, Tyr, another of the points that you emphasized just a minute ago was that this was only supposed to be done after a long-term relationship between patient and physician, and that was not the case here.
Of course not, because most doctors won't do this. Most doctors know that killing their patients is not practicing medicine. There are some doctors who do it, who are mainly ideologues, and indeed we find that although there was a lot of obscurity in this report, at least 6 of the 15 people that were reported, and remember that just because only 15 people were reported, that doesn't mean that's all that actually occurred. There is no punishment in the Oregon law for doctors who fail to report assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
They're told to report it, but if they don't report it, well, there's nothing to be done.
So one
that's
can naturally...
And I have to make it very clear, that is done on purpose. It is to give the appearance of regulation and control without the actuality.
Mm-hmm.
This is Clinton time. Whenever assisted suicide advocates speak, you better parse their words, and you better look just as you might at, and, you know, I don't mean to bring in Bill Clinton, because he's opposed to assisted suicide, so we like him on that regard, but you have to be very careful with what they say. For example, in the Oregon law, they say, well, a patient has to be capable. Capable is not the same thing as competent. Capable means you can communicate. Competent means you can make good decisions. And to give you a story, there was a man, and this is a true story, who cut his hand off with a saw because he thought he saw the devil on his hand. And when they wanted to sew his hand back on, he said no. And they respected him, so he lost his hand. Even though he was hallucinating, he was capable because he was able to communicate health care decisions. But he wasn't competent. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so under the Oregon law, you don't have to be competent to choose assisted suicide. You merely have to be capable. That's just one example of how they pull the shroud of falsehood and a subterfuge around these issues. But getting to the long-term physician,
sure.
The first patient that died under this, the only reason we know details is that Compassion in Dying, CID, which is one of the big advocacy groups, issued a press release saying, oh boy, the first assisted suicide has occurred, and released some details. The woman's own doctor refused to assist her suicide. She had breast cancer. She went to a second doctor who diagnosed her as depressed and wouldn't assist her suicide. So she went to Compassion in Dying's medical director, who said, oh, you're not depressed, you're just frustrated, talked to her by phone, referred her to a rubber stamp death doctor who wrote the prescription, and she was dead in 2.5 weeks. According to the New England Journal of Medicine study, which somehow the media didn't seem to think was worthy of note, some of the patients had 15-day relationships with the doctors who wrote the prescriptions. That's rampant Kevorkianism.
And that's
not a careful practice, medical urgency, long-term relationship. It's rubber-stamp death doctors who will write a prescription based on ideology more than anything else.
You point out that Measure 16 actually is weighted in favor of leading people who are clinically depressed down that path.
Well, it's because you don't have to get the only time you even have to see a psychiatrist is if a doctor suspects you're not capable. Remember, capable is communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychiatrist they're going to send you to, because you're going to have deaf psychiatrists, that is, ideologues who believe in this, you know, are going to find, oh, well, of course you want to die. You've got cancer. That's not being depressed. I mean, it's self-fulfilling prophecies throughout this whole agenda. And yet, people will say, oh, my gosh, it's choice. It's choice, yet Medicaid is now covering assisted suicide in Oregon. Medicaid is rationed in Oregon. People are unable to get some health care for very serious conditions, poor people in Oregon, that could lead them to want assisted suicide. And we just had a case in Oregon of a man with ALS who, it turns out, couldn't swallow the medicine. So his brother-in-law said, according to the Oregonian, that he had to help. He refused to say what he meant by he had to help. Could this mean a plastic bag over his head? Could this mean a pillow? Could this mean choking? Could this mean helping him swallow? Who knows what it means, because he won't say. And yet the Oregon DA can't do much of an investigation because the body's already been cremated. And the death regulators in Oregon have said, well, we can't investigate each and every one of these cases. And you know why? Because they don't care. And this is another example of the slippery slope. And now in response to this, we're being told, well, gosh, this law discriminates against people who can't swallow. Exactly what opponents said would happen. They're beginning to potentially talk about lethal injections now. Exactly what opponents said would happen. But because we've gotten to the place in Oregon where killing is good, we no longer care. I feel like Cassandra. We warn, everything we say is going to happen, well, you know, we're told we're wrong. We're told we're paranoid. We're told we're fantasists. We're told we're making it up. And then when it all occurs and we say, look, just like we said, people say, so?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Cassandra, the ancient prophetess who could see the future, but no one would believe her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a feeling that I know well, and indeed I've been talking about assisted suicide and eugenics and the antecedent of Nazi Germany and where it led to there, and I've been warning people about things like this, and I've been treated, frankly, like I had a D blank 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 growing out of my head, so I know the feeling. One of the things that you cite both in Forced Exit and in your Wall Street Journal column is the precedent of the Netherlands, which has state health care and is a much more humane society on the whole than ours, and yet euthanasia there is completely out of control.
Well, in fact, there have been studies in the British medical journals and other journals that say it specifically is out of control. Just as in the Netherlands, about 59% of assisted suicides go unreported. Doctors do not report them, and yet advocates will say it's a very rarely done procedure, yet most doctors are refusing to comply with the guidelines.
Now, bear in mind, that's 59%. Do not report the suicides.
Or the euthanasias. More than assisted suicide in the Netherlands, doctors give lethal injections. 95% of the killings by doctors in the Netherlands are lethal injections. 5% are assisted suicide, and the reason for that is assisted suicide often goes awry. People might vomit, they might go into extended coma, they might not die, so doctors generally like to give poison shots of curare in the Netherlands, or massive overdoses of morphine intended to kill, which the Dutch government doesn't even count as euthanasia because they're so defensive about all the killing going on in their country.
And you also cite a statistic that 1 out of 5 Dutch, quote, euthanasia, unquote, cases, the patient did not ask to be killed. Now, I think we can assume that 59% of the doctors do not report euthanasia or assisted suicide, and then of what's left, 1 in 5, the patient didn't request it.
That's right, and all we have to do is take a look and see that doctors are now killing babies in their cribs because they're born with disabilities. And if you don't think that that's not bigotry, if you don't think that that's not a violation of human rights, then go and read about what happened in Germany in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. The Holocaust began with the killing of babies born with disabilities, and don't tell me it was done in secret, because the very first one that led to it was a request from the parents, or at least the father, to Adolf Hitler, who sent his personal doctor to make sure things were done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And also, assisted suicide and euthanasia was promoted in Germany long before Hitler was ever dreamed of coming to power. It started with a book in 1920 called Permission to Destroy: Life Unworthy of Life, in which 3 categories of killable people were pronounced. One was terminally ill people, the second was permanently unconscious people, and the third were disabled people. And we're now in this country, in the United States of America, dehydrating unconscious and cognitively disabled people who need feeding tubes to death because of quality of life. We're taking away their nutrition and their hydration so they dehydrate to death in nursing homes and in hospitals all across this country. It happens routinely, and it's legal, and it's considered ethical, even though it is abhorrent. We are in Oregon allowing doctors to prescribe poison for people with a diagnosis of terminal illness. And, of course, we're moving towards that for disabled people. Kevorkian, most of the people Kevorkian has killed have been disabled instead of terminally ill. 4 at least had no physical illness whatsoever. The man wants to experiment on people while they're still alive. He started trying to be able to do experiments on prisoners being executed in death penalty cases. He spent years trying to get the permission to do that before he even thought of going to sick and disabled people, only when he found out that no one was going to let him participate in executions and play with dying people, did he then move to dying and disabled people, and yet he's called compassionate. You take one look at Jack of Orc, and you could see he gives a damn about the people who he's killing. Thomas Yoke, he was asked about him, and he laughed, and he said, I don't even know what he was saying. I couldn't understand a word he said. And yet the people of the United States think he's compassionate because they refuse to look at the truth. And if I'm sounding angry and I'm sounding frustrated, I am, because one of the things that I want to make sure happens is if we're going to go down this poisonous, destructive road, no one's going to come up to me and said, why didn't someone tell me?
Mm-hmm.
This is destructive. It's poisonous. It is. It makes people who are marginalized and defenseless feel like they're burdens, feel like they're unwanted. I've talked to people who are terminally ill who feel that this is an agenda that's aimed right at them to tell them that they should get out of here because they're costing too much money or they're burdens on their family. It's a terrible, destructive thing, and people are yawning, and I find that very disturbing.
One of the things that I pointed out in my research about the T4, the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, which was the Nazi euthanasia program, which again grew out of the Binding and Hoke text that we've talked about in our earlier discussions,
right,
was that the people who were ultimately used to staff the mass extermination centers such as Auschwitz and Treblinka were trained at the euthanasia centers, where they were hardened to the experience of seeing defenseless people sent to their deaths. And
well,
then
and we have to say two things. One, just because euthanasia was practiced in Nazi Germany doesn't mean that euthanasia here would lead to Nazi death camps, you know, mass killing of Jews. But there are other ways to fall off ethical cliffs.
Briefly, the one point that I wanted to make was the desensitization factor, because
exactly.
Gradually they got used to this. And what came to mind when you mentioned Kevorkian was that grotesque 60 Minutes episode which you've written about. And I think that members of the listening audience should stop and ask about those yawns, which you very appropriately referred to, and ask whether perhaps in a certain mediated sense we are all staffing the T4 centers in that we are being desensitized via the mass media to something that we should be extremely sensitive toward.
You know, when I was traveling in the Netherlands when I researched forced exit, and I talked to both proponents over there and opponents. I talked to the lawyers and the doctors who have pushed that agenda, and I've talked to some opponents. And I went and I talked to one medical ethicist, and I was puzzled about something. During World War II in the Netherlands, when Germany occupied the Netherlands, the head general, I forgot his name, tried to force Dutch doctors to begin to follow the path that had been voluntarily engaged in by German doctors. No German doctor was forced to kill any disabled baby. No German doctor was forced to starve any disabled or mentally retarded child, which is what they did. And they tried to push Dutch doctors into this category. And the way they did that was to say that medical practice is not only a private function, but also one in which the doctor owes a duty to the state to perform certain public duties. And the Dutch doctors knew what that meant. And so what they did was they took down their shingles. And they said, no, we're not going to participate in that. It was civil disobedience in an occupied country. Can you imagine the courage? And so 100 Dutch doctors were sent to concentration camps from which many did not come back. And in the end, successfully resisted going into killing people because they were disabled, killing babies because they were disabled, euthanasia, and so forth. Yet their grandchildren are embracing what Dutch doctors fought to prevent themselves from having to do. It's amazing. And if you take a look at the Netherlands in 73, if you told the people then who were supporting euthanasia, that's when euthanasia got started in the Netherlands, as a last resort, only when nothing else could be done to relieve unbearable suffering, which, of course, is the same story we always see. If you'd said to them in 73, if you start this, you're going to end up killing babies, you're going to have at least 1,000, probably 5,000, unrequested euthanasias per year, you're going to allow people to be killed because they're depressed without physical injury, without any physical illness, as they're also doing, you're going to be killing chronically ill people, there will be a case of a woman with anorexia, that was in remission who was afraid of going back into pinging and purging, so her doctor killed her, and that was acceptable. You're going to have the woman who was haunted, ironically, by Holocaust memories, who wanted to be killed, was killed by her doctor. All of these horrors are going to happen in 1973 if you go down this one step. And if the Dutch people had believed that that was true, I'm convinced they would have said, no, we're not going to do that. But the Dutch people did not believe it, and now they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So now we move to the United States, and we're saying, listen, red flags, storm warnings, even in Oregon, after only 1 year, you've already had a case in which a man died very difficultly. You've had a situation now where we're beginning to call, it looks like, for lethal injections. You've got people who were not in the medical urgency for which it was sold. You've got people being killed by doctors who they barely even know. In terms of lethally prescribing, storm warning, beware. And people in Oregon are kind of going, and the rest of the country is not paying a whole lot of attention.
Well,
and
actually, I wish I could interrupt.
It's going to lead us to some very, very bad things.
The thing, I wish they weren't paying attention because they're paying attention to the wrong aspects.
They're paying attention to the propaganda. Because
exactly.
Because that's the first impression.
Because here
in
California.
The media is truly failing in this story.
Yeah.
They will get press releases. They'll basically write the stories based on the press release, call somebody who doesn't even know all the details yet, usually a Catholic bishop, to get the impression that this is just the church against the rationalists. And so there'll be an opposing comment or two. But they won't even investigate or explore what's really going on here. Context, content. And then by the time I get the story, I get an article published, say, in the Wall Street Journal a week later, because it takes time for the Wall Street Journal to have the space, assuming they accept what I want to write, which isn't guaranteed by any stretch. You know, you've already set a first impression into concrete, and then getting people to unthink their first impressions is very difficult. And that's just life in the big city. I'm going to have to deal with it. But our side has a difficult time making news. You know, we can't write a press release that says, hey, look at this person with ALS died peacefully and calmly in his sleep because he got good medical care, because that's not news. It happens all the time. It's only news when somebody with ALS is killed or assists in suicide, and then we're told that that had to be done to avoid unremitting suffering, when it's not true.
The California bill that was introduced about a week and a half ago was based on the erroneous reporting of the, quote, success, unquote, of Measure 16 in Oregon.
Well, that's not exactly true. They might have said that, but they've been planning this for months.
Well, that may be, I'm saying that Ms. Ariner, who is right here in Berkeley, by the way,
in the Bay Area. By the way, she's also introduced a bill. It's not a companion bill, but it should be. It's AB 754, I believe, is the number. And let me confirm, it's AB 754. But what the bill purports to do is deal with Medi-Cal and HMOs, and what the bill allows to occur is for the state to force HMOs that have contracts with Medicaid, which is the Medi-Cal program, force their doctors into capitation contracts. So the capitation contract is the kind that says, I'll give you $10 a month, you have to provide all care.
Mm-hmm.
Or another kind of capitation contract is, I'll give you $40 a month, but if you refer that patient to a specialist outside of your group, you're going to have to pay for it yourself.
Mm.
Capitation contracts are the most destructive kind for patients, because they are the most promotive of cutting care.
So if you take
the assisted suicide law, which will make HMOs a ton of money, because killing and people dying quicker rather than later saves HMO's money, which is where how they make their profits. Imagine the money to be saved if somebody doesn't spend the last 18 months of his or her life fighting cancer, but assisting suicide, or somebody with ALS and so forth.
And
you put capitation contracts, you force doctors into capitation contracts, which causes them to reduce quality of care.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well call these the HMO Profit Protection Acts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is being introduced by a so-called Berkeley liberal who's supposed to care about the defenseless and the disabled and the discriminated against, and yet she is putting in the laws that will not only discriminate against disabled people and dying people and people without health insurance and people on Medi-Cal, but could end up causing their death.
I would point out, too, that, again, we're recording this on March 14th of 1999, and just this past week, the week after Ms. Ariner introduced the bill, for assisted suicide is that there's been a major news story, which is that many of the HMOs are going to be failing because they're not turning enough profit. I think when one juxtaposes news like that with the already slippery slope, which is becoming steeper and more slippery by the minute, I think it is a truly scary scenario that's developing, or at least it should be. But again, too many people are watching 60 Minutes and Kevorkian and yawning about this.
Derek Humphrey just wrote a book called Freedom to Die. Derek Humphrey founded the Hemlock Society. He has a chapter in there in which he says the real point of this is to save money for health care. And he calls it the abandonment of the unproductive. It's one of the few examples of candor in Derek Humphrey's life. But that's exactly what we're talking about. This is the morality of abandoning disabled infants on hills and abandoning the elderly and the infirm by the side of the trail. We are saying that their lives aren't worth taking care of anymore. Derek Humphrey himself has now come out and admitted that that's the truth. And maybe this society no longer cares about protecting people and vulnerable people. Maybe we are just an I, me, me society. But it strikes me that what we should be is an us, us, we society. We're in this together. We're a forest. We're not a bunch of trees just standing next to each other. What happens to my neighbor is important to what happens to me. And when somebody is exploited or abandoned, or when somebody feels that they're selfish for staying alive and so they decide to take poison, that impacts every single one of us if we give a damn anymore.
You point out a quote from an African-American gentleman. By the way, we're down to about the last minute of the interview here, Wesley, who says that in examining physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, he said, man, we're losing our Ubuntu, which seems to me in many ways a nice way of closing the interview. Could you explain what he meant by that?
Well, Ubuntu is I believe a Swahili word. It may be a Zulu word.
Zulu word in the book, yeah.
Zulu word, which is like the human soul, the collective soul, only it's much deeper than that. It probably doesn't have an exact English translation. But when this man went to Africa and learned the word and really fell in love with it, it means all that is good about humanity, all that makes us different than animals, that essential human spark that is really human in nature. And this whole issue, we are losing our Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
We are basically, I think, dropping people out of the lifeboat and not caring. And if we start dropping one out of the lifeboat because we don't think their lives are worth living, at some point each and every one of us will find ourselves in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Wesley, in the last few seconds here, what would you recommend that people do about this issue?
Well, I think they need to get involved and start agitating against it. Advocates for the Poor are now involved and they're agitating against it. And to get information, they can call the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force at 1-800-958-5678. It's online.
Repeat that one more time and give the web address, because there will probably be some people scribbling.
All right, 1-800-958-5678 during business hours, East Coast time,
mm-hmm.
and go to iaetf.org. iaetf.org is where the website is, and there's plenty of information on the task force website, and the task force makes sure that it gets information to people. They don't editorialize. They just point out what's going on. If they do editorialize, like in their newsletter, they'll say it's an editorial.
Okay. One more time, the number and website.
800-958-5678. I hope people will call the task force and get involved, and iaetf.org.
All righty. Well, there you have it, people. And we've been visiting once again with Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, and getting a hold of and reading that book is something else they could do. Wesley, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you.